You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the October 2023 issue of Vanity Fair magazine, which features Bad Bunny on the cover. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the editor's letter, with photograph by Mark Seliger of Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief. Susan Casey, who uncovers new details about the final fatal journey of the Titan submersible in this issue, has been participating in and reporting on deep-sea expeditions for years. So when she describes Titan's last ascent as a tragedy in waiting, she does so with earned expertise. The ocean, as Casey writes, is an inexorable force against which glib tech mantras like move fast and break things have no traction. The thing you break is most likely to be your own. Exploration obviously carries risk, and even the best efforts at managing it cannot prevent disaster. Think of the Space Shuttle Challenger explosion, witnessed in devastating real time by the youth of my generation. But the story of the Titan, and the story of the Titanic for that matter, are a reminder that the race to innovate is often powered by hubris. The great shroud of the sea rolls on, and all we're left with is sorrow for the loss. Pell-mell innovation is also the topic of Nick Bilton's feature on artificial intelligence, although the relevant parties might disagree on the form of hubris involved. Are we hopeless narcissists to pursue the invention in the first place? Or is it vainglorious on the part of Homo sapiens, as Larry Page seems to have it, to assume we'll always have a monopoly on planetary dominance? Maybe we're destined to step aside for a machine species that plays Adam to our fusty Old Testament God. And wouldn't it be poetic justice for AI to solve a problem like, say, climate change, by eradicating its primary causes, in other words, people? The AI train has left the station, as Nick reports, and as it makes its presence known everywhere, from journalism to film to medicine, it puts us stubborn humans in the position of embracing new capabilities while asserting values like creativity and originality. We are making the case for ourselves, to ourselves. For defenders of the humanities, this is a familiar refrain. Could AI have written Moby Dick? Would it have bothered to? But the stakes have never been higher. Tapping the brakes on technological advances has a historically poor track record, but it would be nice to maintain control of the wheel. Some say the world will end in fire. Some say gray goo. Read Nick's piece and you'll see how appetizing that looks. I understand the tidy paradox of being outsmarted by our own exceedingly clever invention. After all, that twist has been the stuff of literature for centuries, and my generation saw the movie 2001 when it was still a vision of the future. But I'm enough of a humanist to hope that our funny, irrational existence can keep the machines guessing. here are some of the contributors to the issue. Susan Casey, The Last Descent. The Titan tragedy brought up a lot of emotions because I'd been watching Ocean Gate's operation, fearing the worst since 2018, says the best-selling writer whose book, The Underworld, Journeys to the Depths of the Ocean, published by Doubleday, takes a deep dive into the world of undersea exploration. Phil Clay, War of the Worlds. Clay, who explores the U.S. military's foray into preparing for an evolution of war, is an award-winning author, Marine Corps veteran, and professor at Fairfield University. His novel, Missionaries, was named one of President Barack Obama's favorite books of the year in 2020. Grace Aldrich, Future Tense. The Kansas City-based fine artist and illustrator's work often wrestles with themes of the surreal, seeking to uncover the intrinsic darkness that can be found everywhere. Whether good or bad, AI can and already has uprooted our lives in many ways, she says. Nicole Chapoteau, Bad Bunny's Year of Rest and Relaxation. It was such a treat to shoot Benito in Puerto Rico, says Vanity Fair fashion director Chapoteau, who styled the artist for our cover. I was able to pull items from a local shop, and the food was delicious. Never have I ever had rice and beans on set, she says. Sylvester Macaw, Bad Bunny's Year of Rest and Relaxation. I force myself to contradiction in order to avoid confirming my own taste. Everybody practices art in his own way, says the Hungarian photographer who shot Bad Bunny in his native Puerto Rico, using local culture as a rich source of inspiration. Carl Hiassen, Swamp Things. Hiassen is a best-selling novelist, former longtime columnist at the Miami Herald, and author of the new book, Wrecker, published by Knopf. The Florida native offers an inside look at the DeSantis-led state. I'm making a bingo card of all the places in Florida my book gets banned. father figure, Alex Cooper takes the Call Her Daddy podcast to new heights by Britt Hennemuth, with photographs by Kanye Iwana. The show that prompted Jane Fonda to call Alex Cooper one of the best interviewers I've ever had is returning for season 3, and that's not even the biggest news for its 29-year-old star. Moving Call Her Daddy away from Barstool Sports, where it began, resulted in a Spotify deal worth around $60 million. She's also turned her attention to launching Gen Z talent into the stratosphere via her own media company, Trending. Now, Cooper is here to talk and to listen. Raised in suburban Pennsylvania, Cooper was the middle child of a TV producer father and a psychologist mother who helped her and her friends get through adolescence. My house was where you came to process emotions that maybe weren't as accepted. At Boston University, she wore her signature daddy sweatshirt to make guys feel uncomfortable. They'd be frustrated, and I could tell it was because I shouldn't have this on my chest. They're like, "We're daddy," and I'm like, "No, I'm daddy." As the dust settles from her moves away from Barstool and her original co-host, Sophia Franklin, Cooper is proud that I fought for something that I had built. I can sleep well at night because I know I worked my ass off. Getting that compliment from Fonda was the coolest moment of my career. I cried to my parents afterward. Another guest highlight? Miley Cyrus. I'm never starstruck, but I was a massive Hannah Montana fan as a kid. Her most surprising guests were Post Malone. "He's the sweetest soul, yes ma'am and sorry ma'am," and Gwyneth Paltrow. I think that her reputation is interesting because her vibe is so lovely. For the most part, Cooper's been an open book, until she met her fiancé, film and TV producer Matt Kaplan. Initially, she'd only call him Mr. Sexy Zoom Man on air. "I actually have to work on this in therapy to be like, you cannot exploit this relationship." Her deal with Spotify ends next summer, but she knows her value. Company data reported in the press revealed just how much a Call Her Daddy appearance can boost a guest profile. "There's math and stats," she laughs. "Gotta write it down for the next deal." Living Study. A storied Washington, D.C. museum finds fresh purpose by Abigail Tracy. In 1987, the National Museum of Women in the Arts opened with a simple but righteous mission: to reinsert women into the history of art. 36 years later, the objective has grown to encompass activism in the living world. "We're both a museum and a megaphone," director Susan Fisher Sterling says. "If women are left out of the arts, what does that say about us in the larger social landscape?" Two blocks from the White House, the 93,400-square-foot landmark building, pictured here, once a Masonic temple, is showcasing its ambitions after a two-year, $67.5 million reimagining of the space by architectural firm Sandra Vicchio and Associates. The inaugural exhibition, The Sky's the Limit, opens October 21st and features sculptures, some of which are pictured here, large-scale works, and immersive installations by 13 contemporary artists. An opportunity, says Chief Curator Catherine Watt, for every visitor to have their thinking about creative women expanded exponentially. Keziah Weir writes on books, lifestyled. Three new books collect bounteous beauty from pop art to the automotive. The Atlas of Car Design. This rich history traces more than a century of stylish autos, from the mass-produced 1901 Oldsmobile curved dash to the Ford Bronco, pictured here, to the Tesla Model X. Written by Jason Barlow and Guy Bird, and with an introduction by Brat Burke. Published by Phaedon. Pauline Boti. Mark Kristall's illustrated biography brings the lesser-known British pop artist Pauline Boti, who died of cancer at age 28, into vivid focus. Called a Wimbledon Bardot at art school, she painted lush depictions of feminine sexuality and desire, published by Francis Lincoln. What's My Name? Micaiah Carter's first monograph, with text by Tracy Ellis Ross, showcases the photographer's emotive rendering of his subjects, from an anonymous little boy inspired by Carter's own childhood, to portraits of famous faces like Zendaya and Kehinde Wiley, published by Prestel. Six Pack. Novels and nonfiction scour the world, outside and within. Lou Reed, The King of New York. Will Hermes portrays a complex portrait encompassing Reed's politics and sexuality, as well as his work from the Velvet Underground through his solo career. Published by FSG. How to Say Babylon. From poet Safia Sinclair, a trenchant memoir of growing up in Jamaica under the ultra-strict eye of her Rastafarian father, and of finding her poetic voice. Published by 37 Inc. The Wolves of Eternity. Karl Ove Knausgård's newest finds adult siblings strangers to each other, considering immortality and death. One in the 1980s, the other present day. Published by Penguin Press. People Collide. A writer finds that he switched bodies with his wife, and that she, along with his body, has disappeared. Happily, Isle McElroy's novel, while humorous, bends contemplative rather than absurd. Published by Harper Via. Land of Milk and Honey. In a time plagued by extinctions and food shortages, a chef prepares immoderate meals for a billionaire and his paying guest, and see Pam Zhang's sensuous gutting novel, published by Riverhead. A Day in the Life of Abed Salama. Nathan Thrall's immersive, troubling reporting follows a Palestinian father's search for his 5-year-old son in the wake of a bus accident outside Jerusalem, published by Metropolitan. Brevity and Soul. Short story collections worth lingering over this fall. Roman Stories by Giampa Lahiri. Writing first in her adopted Italian, Lahiri conjures freighted connections. A husband longs for another woman. A family weathers racist attacks. In and around a Rome humming with life. Published by Knopf. The Hive and the Honey by Paul Yoon. In 7 virtuosic stories, centering characters that include a 17th-century samurai and a contemporary New York immigrant, Yoon captures scenes of the Korean diaspora. Published by Mary Sue Rucci. Our Strangers by Lydia Davis. With signature wit and depth, Davis presents a compendium of flash and short fiction. Bypassing Amazon, the title is available solely at libraries and indie stores. Published by Bookshop Editions. This is Salvaged by Vahini Vara. A teen whose brother has died of cancer takes a job as a phone sex operator. An artist constructs a biblical ark and more droll, astute snapshots of human relations. Published by Norton. Split Second by Daisy Shaw Ellis, with photograph by Christopher Anderson, Rolex Perpetual 1908 in yellow gold. The year 1908 marked Times Square's first ball drop, ended with a record-breaking two-hour airplane flight, and witnessed Ernest Shackleton's Antarctica Nimrod expedition, as well as the introduction of Ford's Model T. It's also when founder Hans Wilsdorf trademarked Rolex. Now, the watch behemoth takes that seminal year as the moniker for the debut style in its new collection, its first catalog expansion in more than a decade. The Perpetual 1908 pairs aesthetic nods to the archive, early Oyster Perpetuals, as well as the President Obama-favored retired Cellini, or Cellini, with crisp, modern numerals at 3, 9, and 12, and an exhibition back that reveals its sleek internal movement, ensuring its wearer won't miss a single scintillating moment. Here's what's trending. Paint the town. The coat is the picture, John Singer Sargent once told a portrait sitter, reluctant to don cashmere in the summer. At the Museum of Fine Arts Boston, fashioned by Sargent, explores the artist's focus on garments and his penchant for styling his subjects himself. Here, an ode to the power and passion of vivid red. John Singer Sargent's Dr. Potsy at Home is among the works on view through January 15, 2024. Going rouge, Erin Rose de Grosse Rouge Eau de Parfum, Loewe dress, Tiffany & Company earrings, Polo Ralph Lauren bag, Gabriella Hearst trench coat, Chanel Le Vernis nail color and incendiaire, Tory Burch shoes, Valentino Garavani bag, Shiseido Techno Satin gel lipstick in short circuit, Ileana Macri necklace, interior bra, Gucci shirt, Omega Watch, all pictured here. Thank you. Marty Without the Mob. Killers of the Flower Moon is part of a rich but often overlooked strain of Scorsese's storied career by David Canfield. Martin Scorsese isn't afraid of what he doesn't know. He's the gutsiest director I've ever met in my life, says Irwin Winkler, who's produced Scorsese films for more than three decades. Scorsese may be best known for iconic crime stories, inspired by his own Italian-American upbringing in New York, but this is also the man who delivered Hollywood's best Edith Wharton adaptation, darted from The Color of Money's modern setting to The Last Temptation of Christ, and helmed a Liza Minnelli musical being revived nearly 50 years later. His range is on display again in this fall's Killers of the Flower Moon, a haunting, real-life tragedy set in the Osage Nation of Oklahoma. His fierce determination to do what he feels is the right thing for a movie is really unique, says Winkler. That's no more evident than when it comes to Scorsese's non-mob hits, a remarkable catalog unto itself. Killers of the Flower Moon, 2023. The movie is adapted from David Grant's book about the century-old murders of Osage Native Americans, but Scorsese greatly expanded the indigenous perspective. He worked with Rodrigo Prieto, cinematographer, on his last four movies, filming at the sites of the violence and choosing rich naturalistic colors. Most Osage rituals have to do with the elements, sun, water, Prieto says. It's always an interpretation. That's part of art. But we really tried for authenticity. Silence, 2016. This drama, following 17th century Jesuit priest in Japan, maybe Scorsese's most underrated faith-driven film, as it confronts the unknowns of spirituality. The Taiwan set presented unwieldy conditions, with weather changing wildly by the hour. Scorsese called Silence a passion project, more than 25 years in the making. The Wolf of Wall Street, 2013. Scorsese wrestled with whether this kinetic, drug-fueled Wall Street epic was the right movie for him to make at the time, but Winkler nudged him. To do this the right way, you had to really go out and push yourself, and Marty's great at that, Winkler says. I don't think another director could do it. The Age of Innocence, 1993. While Scorsese had made a number of New York classics by 1993, he entered uncharted territory with this Gilded Age romantic drama based on the novel. Its sumptuous brilliance can be credited to Scorsese's famous attention to detail. Perfection of the period, as Oscar-nominated hairstylist Alan D'Angerio describes the design team's mantra, it was all Marty, all we did was follow his lead. Raging Bull, 1980. Early in development, the brilliant boxing drama starring Robert De Niro seemed doomed. The executives hated it. Scorsese lacked interest. But after a drug overdose sent him to the hospital, the director felt newly, intensely connected to the visceral character study. Bob visited him in the hospital, Winkler says. They sat down and talked, and Marty found himself in the story. New York, New York, 1977. Gearing up to make this starry big band musical, Winkler wanted Gene Kelly to direct at first, but decided that the hotshot behind Mean Streets and Taxi Driver would be a more unexpected choice. I knew he would bring grittiness to the story, Winkler says. The movie bombed, but it became a Broadway musical this year, and there are rumors of a miniseries adaptation. Like its director, it has stood the test of time. And each of these six mentioned movies are pictured here in still shots. Thank you. dark matter, nodding to gothic horror and cyber dystopia, Moody Makeup brings a glamorous edge to existential concerns by Laura Regensdorf, with photograph by Autumn DeWild. When the vampires are played by Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie, pictured here, chiseled features, haute froideur, it's hard not to side with the bloodthirsty. The Hunger, Tony Scott's 1983 directorial debut, opens in a New York nightclub as Bauhaus frontman Peter Murphy sings the propulsive Bela Lugosi's Dead. The lovers select their prey, a sunglasses at night guy and a redhead with slashes of eyeliner and crimson lips. She dances, unaware that she exits the film in 6 minutes flat. A speed-walking cast of models made a similarly fleeting appearance at Marc Jacobs' Fall 2023 show. The designer's ode to the 80s manifested as bleached wigs, cropped black stockings, a striped suit fit for Beetlejuice. But it was the drained faces and brusque red mouths, together with show notes credited to OpenAI and ChatGPT, that brought The Hunger to mind, as if updating the plot for an era of vampire electronics. We wanted a futuristic vibe, so that's why we went for that gaunt look, says makeup artist Diane Kendall, who hollowed models' eye sockets with gray shadows. Her inspiration was 1982's Blade Runner, directed by Ridley Scott, Tony's brother. Kendall did dab highlighter on the cheekbones, nose, and tear ducts, because you still want the girls to look beautiful, even though it's not the most beautiful makeup. The impulse, to veer into darkness, is the order of the day. From Wednesday, slated for a post-strike return, to Olivia Rodrigo's music video for Vampire. The lyrics, lambast an ex, bloodsucker, fame effer, and Rodrigo has bite, her oxblood lipstick offset by ethereal glossy lids. Makeup artist Kathy Jung wanted the pop star to look powerful and vulnerable at the same time, she explains. The spidery, clumpy lashes were Rodrigo's idea, like tears hardened into spiky resolve. Makeup Beauty's amped-up mascara, Tarantulash, creates exactly that effect. I didn't want it to be like voluminous, feathery bullshit, says co-founder and makeup artist Joe Baker, referring to the usual puffed-up marketing names. Hers is to the point. She teased it months ahead of launch, posting a photo of an orange and black tarantula alongside her two-tone Critics' Choice makeup look for Natasha Lyonne. This is not for the faint-hearted, Baker says of the fast-build formula that lasts. I could be caught in the rain. I can have a full emotional meltdown, which, let's be honest, can happen to any of us. That was unexpectedly the case for at least one damp-eyed guest at Edward Arte's Fall 2023 show, where Tori Amos' Winter accompanied the fantastically gloomy procession. Hair is gray and the fires are burning, Amos soothsays from 1992. Witchy liner, pictured here, set the mood, seen first with a suite of neo-morticia black dresses. We kept pushing it with early punk references and gothic fairy notes, says James Calliardos of the eyeliner shapes, which he sketched with a brow pencil for symmetry before inking with NARS Climax. Though it's hard to do, I know a lot of girls that want to rock this look. Even that severe beauty statement found fanciful counterpoints in Rodarte's metallic fringe dresses and nearby tables set with glitter-covered feast. The future, however uncertain, shines bright. And some of the cosmetics are pictured here. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.